You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network with your host, Dan Gould. Virginia History with Rick Britton starts right now. Local historian and cartographer Rick Britton has been a good friend of the Charlottesville Podcasting Network for many years. He joins me in studio for the third of an exciting new series on Virginia's colorful 18th and 19th century history. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you doing, Dan?
I'm doing well, thank you. Are you? You must be getting pretty excited about your trip to Gettysburg.
Yeah, we've got a great 3-day trip to Gettysburg coming up. It's October 26th through Friday, October 28th. And the reason it's exciting is usually what we take people on are day trips for a single day. You know, we go out in the morning at 8 or 9 o'clock and we come back at 5:30 or 6 o'clock and we spend the day out and maybe just have one meal together. But here's an opportunity to take a whole group of people on a bus from Charlottesville up to Gettysburg and really take our time. We're going to get 6 hours of battlefield touring by one of the licensed battlefield guides up at Gettysburg. Unfortunately, because of an interesting law that was passed by the U.S. government in the 1920s, I can't legally give a battlefield tour at Gettysburg. Somebody needs to really challenge that on First Amendment as a First Amendment issue, because after all, it is property that belongs to the people of the United States. But anyway, they've got great licensed battlefield guides. So we're going to do 2 hours on the first day's fighting, mostly the fighting on Seminary Ridge. We're going to do 2 hours on the second day, Culp's Hill and Little Round Top being the famous battlefields on the second day, July 2nd, 1863, and 2 hours on Pickett's Charge, probably the most famous attack in American history. And it's going to be a lot of fun. My wife and I are going up a couple of weekends ahead of time to check out the hotel and all of the eateries and all of the other amenities that are within walking distance so that she and I can plan what we're going to do on the 2 evenings that we're there. But it's just going to be a fantastic trip. So if folks are interested in joining us, they can call down to the great folks at the Senior Center Travel Office here in Charlottesville, Virginia. It's 434-974-6538.
And we shouldn't forget, you mentioned that you check out the local, you said eateries, but it's more than that. I mean, you also take your tours on to some of the great, great places to eat and while you're on these tours too.
Yeah, and there are other things to do. So, you know, there are great bookstores, as you can imagine, and there's a fantastic visitor center, a brand new visitor center, just a few years old. But there are also other places. For example, within walking distance of the hotel, there's a gentleman named Gibson. His first name escapes me, but he does period photography. So you can actually go there and have him make a tintype of you in garb from the period. So people just love that kind of stuff. There's all kinds of neat things to do.
That's great. Well, I'm sure people will be looking forward to that, and we will give you that phone number again at the end of this podcast. So, looks like we're here to talk a little bit more about the infantry. We said we were going to move on to the cavalry today, but you've got some more cool stuff to tell us about the Civil War infantry.
We've got a lot of stuff to talk about. You know, in the Civil War, there are so many different topics aside from the battles, aside from the generals, aside from the presidents on both sides. There's so many things that usually get left off. And before I forget, we want to invite people to comment and perhaps give us some ideas of future topics. But yeah, we started off on the infantry. We promised folks we're going to go into the cavalry. But a buddy of mine up in Alexandria sent me a New York Times, a link to a New York Times article. And since I mentioned the standard number of battle casualties and casualties of all kinds, and during our last episode, I want to talk a little bit about this article and what it says. The standard number in the past that we've always been taught of total deaths in the Civil War, North and South, was about 618,000. Of course, everybody immediately rounded it up to 620,000. And then people would always say more deaths than all other American wars combined. Well, that was true until the Vietnam War, with its 56,000 American deaths. And those totals then, with World War II, World War I, all the Indian Wars, War of 1812, American Revolution, they went over 620. So if anybody had been paying attention since the Vietnam War, they wouldn't have made that last statement. Well, researchers have been studying microfilm of the census information taken from the 1870 census, and information that has surfaced, more detailed information from the various states on how many casualties they lost. And the new numbers are really startling, but I guess they shouldn't be too surprising. They estimate now that in the American Civil War, on both sides, the losses, and it's not just combat casualties, of course, are probably 750,000 and maybe as many as 850,000. Now, why is this important for us to still be trying to figure out how many people died in the Civil War? Well, it's important because the larger number, 850,000, even at 750,000, that's 20% more than we thought in the past. At 850,000, it's significantly more. That means that more households were affected by this horrible tragedy, this four-year tragedy that almost broke our nation in two. More households were affected. There were more orphans and widows after the war than we thought in the past. That's why that's important.
And that's amazing, too. I mean, 600,000 deaths is unimaginable.
It is unimaginable.
And 800,000, it's beyond unimaginable.
Right, so. It is. It is beyond unimaginable. And it gets us a better idea of how cataclysmic these 4 years of war were. And you need to add 850,000 possible total deaths in the American Civil War out of a population of 32 million. So to equate that to modern terms, our population in the United States today is about 10 times that many, or almost 320 million. So multiply 850,000 by 10, and it would be the equivalent of us getting into a war nowadays and suffering 8.5 million casualties. That would be the equivalent of a major city completely gone, completely obliterated.
Staggering, really.
It is really staggering.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to talk about, maybe a little bit more uplifting from that last conversation, is one of the great things that people always used to say about the Civil War, and I started reading about the Civil War in the late 1950s and the early 1960s, as soon as I learned to read. One of the things that we were always taught was that the Civil War was the last of the Napoleonic Wars, the last of the old wars, and the first modern war. What they mean when they talk about the last of the Napoleonic Wars, and this is true to a certain extent, is that by and large, Civil War armies on the battlefield, and this is how this pertains to the infantry that we're supposed to be talking about, by and large, the infantry on the Civil War battlefields were using Napoleonic tactics. We have this interesting kind of concept in military history where armies from one nation tend to study the most famous armies in the world. And of course, in the early 19th century, the most famous army in the world, because it had accomplished so much, it had pretty much overrun all of Western Europe, was the army under Napoleon. And so people were fascinated by his strategy, his tactics on the battlefield, but also how he maneuvered and the different combinations, the different kinds of formations that he used on the battlefield. So that led to Napoleonic tactics being adopted by the rest of the world. And what that meant was, yes, they fought in a line of battle, usually three deep, but they also used massed formations for the attack. That was possible during Napoleonic Wars, when you were using almost exclusively smoothbore weapons, where the effective range on the battlefield was only about 100 yards, which meant that you could approach an enemy formation in a massed formation and suffer very few casualties relatively, and then close with them with a large number of men striking one point. This is where the Civil War is a little bit different. They were using, I would have to say, modified Napoleonic tactics. By and large, the battles were fought on the battlefield by infantry arrayed in two lines, the front rank and the rear rank. So they've gone from three ranks to two ranks. Massed formations were used for attacks, but compared to Napoleonic combat, in a very limited there was a very limited amount of that kind of usage. So was it the last of the Napoleonic Wars? No, I think it had been evolving. Warfare had been evolving, and during the Civil War, it continued to evolve. So it kind of moved away from so much use of those massed formations for the attack. Why? Well, because of the rifled musket. The rifled musket could reach out across the battlefield and bring down an enemy out to 800 yards. 800 yards is a long distance on a Civil War battlefield. Most of the volley fire that was taking place on a Civil War battlefield was done between 200 and 300 yards, but still, that's quite a difference from the 100 yards that was being done with smoothbore volley fire. But one of the things that I find interesting is what do people mean when they talk about the Civil War being the first modern war? And what they meant in the past was, it was the first war, this is what they would say, the first war where railroads were used. It was the first war where telegraph was used for communication. It was the first war with balloon reconnaissance. It was the first war with breech-loading weapons. These are the kinds of things we were taught in the 1960s and the 1970s. It was the first war with a lot of use of trench warfare, and of course that foreshadowed World War I, and it was the first war with ironclads. So here's the big question, is all of that true? And the answer is pretty much no, it's not true. The Crimean War actually saw the first use of railroads. Railroads, of course, by the time of the Civil War had been around for a while. The telegraph, I'm not so sure about. That the Civil War might actually be the first war where the telegraph was used for communications. Balloon reconnaissance. There were Napoleonic battles in the 1790s where balloons were used for aerial reconnaissance. So that predates the Civil War by 70 years. So it's not the first war with balloon reconnaissance. Breech-loading weapons. Breech-loading weapons had been around for a while. Breech-loading weapons were used to a limited extent in the American Revolution. Many, many years, 80 years before the Civil War. Trench warfare. Trench warfare had been around since the dawn of man, since the beginning of warfare. Ironclads. Ironclads had been in the European navies since the early 1850s. So is it right to say that it's the first modern war? And what do you say about all of these different modern sounding military things? Well, I think the way to say it is that the Civil War was the first time that these things were used on a wide scale. A lot of balloon reconnaissance, a lot of the use of the telegraph, a lot of the use of railroads transporting troops back and forth, a lot, especially at the end, a lot of trench warfare in the sieges, like the siege of Richmond and Petersburg. And of course, famously, when it comes to ironclads, the first really heavily publicized battle between two ironclads. And so the Civil War, because of its scale, because it stretched across a continent, actually, and because of the amount of the numbers involved, first popularized all of these things, and these things were first used on a wide scale. And so I think that's the way to really say it. Was it the first modern war? Not really. Things are always evolving.
Sir, of course. And I was wondering while you were talking about that, is it known whether the generals in the Civil War were influenced by the wars of Europe? I mean, did they study European history and look for tactics and other things? I mean, is that how that evolution crosses an ocean?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's absolutely true. In West Point, the officers who had studied at West Point studied Napoleonic tactics, and the Napoleonic drill manuals, of course, were translated into English, into American, and they were taught to the armies as the armies are being organized. And some of the most famous commanders, people like Lee and Stuart and some of the others here in Virginia, actually had some of the memoirs by officers under Napoleon that they read and studied to get more information, to glean more things that they can use from the experiences of Napoleonic combat. Napoleonic warfare, of course, went across a couple of decades and involved battles with hundreds of thousands of men on a battlefield. And so it was experience that directly related and could be used to a certain extent to the battles that they experienced here in Virginia and across the United States during the Civil War. So the basic answer is, yeah, they studied Napoleonic combat.
And when we talked last time about the infantry, you you mentioned that some of the weapons, the rifles, were actually imported. Does that contribute to the kind of evolution, bringing weapons from other countries into
That's a great question, Dan. And I think the answer to that would have to be pretty much no, because the reason the weapons were imported in large numbers is because the armories and the arsenals here and the manufacturing firms couldn't put out enough, couldn't manufacture enough. So it was a limited supply in the United States. So by and large, the things that were being imported from overseas were the older weapons and weapons that were even antiquated, old flintlocks that had been converted to percussion. So I would be hard pressed to think of a weapon that was an infantry weapon that was brought in from abroad that was a brand new design. Now in the artillery, and we'll talk more about the artillery, there were some famous pieces, some Whitworth breech loading rifled cannon that were brought in and used in the Civil War, and they were manufactured in England. But as far as infantry weapons, most of the stuff that was brought from abroad in large numbers, like from Belgium and Austria, like we were talking about, were older, antiquated weapons because of the lack of supply here in the United States. And those things, you know, lots of times regiments would be issued those, and the first opportunity they had, they'd throw those down and pick up something that was a little bit more respectable.
Of course, yes. Every soldier has his pride.
Every soldier has his pride, yeah. And the last thing you want to do is be sitting there in a battle and having to worry about whether your long arm, whether your weapon is going to explode in your face.
Exactly.
Right.
All right. Thank you. We'll be back on October 9th to talk again. What do you have in mind for...
I was thinking we would go into more of some infantry topics. So we talk about things like formation. One of the big questions I get all the time is, did they really fight shoulder to shoulder like the illustrations? We can talk about that. And the actual organization of infantry units.
Great. So listeners, come back and join us on October 9th to learn all about that. And before we go, one more time, if people want to get involved in that tour, that fantastic tour to Gettysburg, give them the number where they can call and get.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. It's the Senior Center Travel Office at 434-974-6538.
Great. And after that trip, we hope you come back and tell us all about it.
I will. I'll tell you all about it.
Join us each second and fourth Sunday for Virginia History with Rick Britton. For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.